2 years ago, voters decided South Dakota must expand Medicaid. Now, another vote on the same subject. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, October 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Medicaid is the nation's public health insurance program for people with low income. Lawmakers want the power to attach work requirements to eligibility. 2 years ago, voters said no to all restrictions. Now voters get to provide nuance to what no actually means. We'll talk about the intersection between work, illness, and health insurance. Plus, our Dakota political junkies bring South Dakota political history to the table. We'll discuss the legacy of Congressman Carl Mundt and the complexities of Mount Rushmore. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Constitutional Amendment F is on the ballot this election season. The amendment would allow the state to impose work requirements on eligible individuals receiving the health care assistance known as Medicaid. First, the arguments for voting against the measure. Shelley Tenapel is Chief Executive Officer of the Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas. She stopped by the SDPB studios alongside Natasha Smith, who has early childhood memories involving being helped by Medicaid.
Well, thanks for having me. Really important topic for me to talk about because I'm a self-proclaimed Medicaid kid. And that means that the access that I had to healthcare in really early formative years of my life, that access was created through Medicaid. And I realize, especially as I've aged and matured and faced my own healthcare complications in adult life, that the earlier interactions with healthcare through the Medicaid program were instrumental, in my trust in healthcare providers and, trust in the science behind many of the recommendations that are made. I think all of that formative trust really started when I was young, and it could not have started if I didn't have access through the Medicaid program.
At what age did you know that you had access to a program?
One of my very first memories as a child is actually getting vaccinated in a WIC office.
Really?
And I don't know if that's something that even exists anymore, but, back in the early 90s, there must have been some sort of program, right, to create, childhood immunization as a priority. And so I must have been five, at the oldest. I must have been five getting vaccinated in a WIC office.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Originally from the southern part of the United States, so I was born in northern Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I spent a lot of my childhood in and out of homeless shelters, domestic violence shelters, extremely food insecure, lots of instability. But a lot of that changed, I think, when we arrived in South Dakota. So the Children's Inn, formerly Children's Inn, I think now it's the Center for Family Safety. But that was my first home in South Dakota, and things, really started to level out and get a lot better once we landed here in the Midwest.
Yeah. Say more about the trust and understanding science. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, being vaccinated at a really young age and growing up in a family that maybe wasn't necessarily inclined to trust healthcare, my parents didn't routinely engage in preventative healthcare, but because the access was there, they familiarized me and my siblings with it. And so, as I aged and as I grew up, I developed my own opinions. I actually went through a phase where I didn't vaccinate my children, and it was a learning and growing kind of period in my life. But ultimately, through my own journey in higher education, learned more about the scientific process, how things are evaluated, what, gathering data looks like, and really, obviously changed my position on that. I vaccinated my children in their later elementary school years, which was a little traumatic on them. Those shots aren't so bad when they're babies, but when they can kick and scream, it's a whole new thing. But that trajectory and that change, I think really was possible because of my earlier experiences. Yeah. And so as an adult, I actually had dysplasia, which is early cancer, or the beginning stages, what could be cervical cancer, found in a routine pap smear or cervical cancer screening. And I think about that, how many women forego cervical cancer screenings, particularly in Hispanic communities, and that's, you know, my lived experience and my ethnicity, why was I doing routine preventative health care? Well, the trust was there. I knew the value in some of that health care, and I knew because when I was little, I had that access and that early formative kind of influence over, you know, my journey.
Yeah. I bet a lot of people, Shelley, have, a lot of people from South Dakota have a memory, if they will sit and think about it, about healthcare and access and work and how it relates to whether it's your mom getting off work to take you to the doctor or so. What comes to mind for you? Why are you passionate about this issue?
Yeah, for sure. As you guys were having that conversation, one of the privileges I've had in my role working in the healthcare access field is to hear so many patient stories and experiences that people have had, and that, you know, when you're having those first signs of whether it's, you know, a heart attack or something really serious, many of us have that same screen where it's like, well, how bad is this? Do I really, you know, how much would an ER visit cost? And really hearing about people having coverage being a life-saving experience because it was just that one question they didn't have to ask themselves before they went and sought help, tried to understand what was happening with them. So, yeah, I mean, similar upbringing in terms of what you're talking about that can I really afford to go to the doctor question that still lingers sometimes back there in the back of my mind. But having the privilege, too, of hearing a lot of experiences where it really is that thing that saves that person's life, whether it's that preventive care or, you know, one of the people we've had a privilege to hear from is a 19-year-old who is a type 1 diabetic. And just talking about how that access to insulin and the testing strips is truly life-saving for her and not something she can afford, you know, on an entry-level job or, you know, a job that doesn't offer health coverage. So just the impact health coverage makes on people's lives every day is really something I feel privileged to be a witness to.
So when we look at this amendment, basically at its core, it would be allowing policymakers to attach a work requirement. It's not the people saying we want a work requirement. We're saying the voters, if they vote for it, would be, hey, this is allowed in conversation. So which one of you wants to address the idea that this is just an amendment, the proponents say, that would allow policymakers to have the conversation? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, I think I want to just talk about a couple of myths. And for me, this is really a barrier that prevents people from getting the coverage that they need. So I just want to state that pretty clearly. But there's a couple of myths that have been shared. And one is that a work requirement promotes work. And I think where we've seen these implemented, it doesn't. It doesn't increase work. What it does do is it decreases working people having health coverage because the rules are confusing or the bureaucracy is hard to surmount. And so if you're thinking I'm pro-work, this is not an amendment that supports work. I think the other thing that you're going to hear is that this is just a friendly amendment to support what the South Dakota people voted for just 2 years ago to expand this coverage. And I just want to remind folks that this is brought not by people who supported the amendment, by people who were against it, and they'll be in charge of implementing it. I mean, folks who kind of didn't want this expansion in the first place. And so those of us who worked for it, were passionate about it, voted for it, are not in favor of this amendment, and I just want to provide that as a reminder.
I want to go back. I want to get back to you in a minute, Natasha, but what you said about it doesn't promote work, do you mean anecdotally or do you have some data to support that?
Sure, yeah. There is one state, Arkansas, that did implement a work requirement during the Trump administration. A judge actually stopped it because so many people were losing their coverage, but it did give us a chance to study the impact of it. And so we know a quarter of the people who were working lost coverage just because of the bureaucratic barriers. And another thing we know from that research is that it did not increase work.
Natasha, what would you add to this, the amendment itself and what it is designed to do, that argument? What is your response?
You know, I think I just have fears and concerns around what narrative it drives, right? That there are individuals that are not working that would exploit, you know, access to healthcare coverage. And I think the truth of it is we have extraordinarily low unemployment rates. And, you know, my concern is that we're not fully wrapping our arms around the fact that poverty is very complex, right? Like, people in poverty work extraordinarily hard just to tread water and keep their head above water, oftentimes stringing together, you know, gig work with, you know, several part-time jobs. I know that was my experience growing up, right? My mom worked extraordinarily hard, but it was very rarely one full-time job. It was several part-time jobs. She needed flexibility because we couldn't afford after-school care. And so she was responsible for picking her children up at the end of every school day. Work hours, you know, just don't necessarily accommodate, you know, a 9 to 2 type of a shift. And so the complexity is there when we think about, you know, what working means. And I worry that we oversimplify it and really lose, you know, that nuance of how difficult it is to be in poverty.
Representative Van Huysen, who is speaking for this amendment later in the show today, will say, well, there are exceptions. The things that you're talking about, the things that were the hypotheticals we will most likely bring up, there would probably be exceptions to that to provide for childcare, you know, people who are engaged in childcare, to provide for people who are engaged in elder care. Concerns that you have, Shelley?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we don't know is the answer to that. So the amendment does not make that clear. And yeah, I think many of us would say if you get that cancer diagnosis and aren't able to work, we wouldn't want you to lose your health coverage. But we can't say that for sure with the amendment the way it is, just sort of unclear what the impacts would be. So we think about moms that have had young kids and not able to get childcare, those people who are in school, especially our young people who are trying to build a better life for themselves, those who are doing elder care. All of those are just question marks. And I think if you're concerned like I am or really believe that those people should have access to healthcare, I think you should vote against this amendment.
What are you hearing from people who supported this before, supported Medicaid expansion? Because that's an important part of this. It's just 2 years ago, voters said that this is something that they wanted. Now, 2 years later, they're being asked to vote on this part of it. Do you think, Shelley, that they already had their say and now they're being asked to say again? Or do you think that there was a desire for some more nuance to the First Amendment?
Yeah, I think this amendment is unneeded. And it undermines the will of the people of South Dakota. We already voted for this, and we don't need this Second Amendment.
Natasha, tell us more about your journey out of poverty and the way that you reflect back on that and realize the things that helped you become the adult that you are today.
Generational poverty is, you know, everything has to go right. You have very little margin for error, right? And in trying to get out of some of that, it's really interesting. You talked about, you know, young mothers and students. My own experience, right, as a young professional where I decided I wanted to go back to school and enter higher education, I had a child at the tender age of 17 years old. You know, the complexity of trying to decide, did I want to lose some of the assistance that I had helping to cover daycare costs so that I could go to school, the healthcare coverage, et cetera. But the reality was, is that I needed to be able to prove full-time employment, which was extraordinarily difficult while I was a full-time student with young children. But those were the options, right? And I'm not somebody that would ever say, well, I did it, you can too. I did it and it was extraordinarily hard.
So you would like it to be different for people coming after you?
Absolutely. I think in South Dakota, you know, one of the reasons I've built a life here is because we take care of our neighbor. That's what we do.
I would just say too, I had a mentor who once said, we used to fight poverty and now we fight the poor. And I think that just calls to mind that statement for sure.
Shelley Tenapel is Chief Executive Officer of the Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas. She was joined in the studio by Natasha Smith. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Every election year, we make our own South Dakota political history. For today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we explore the history we have inherited. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. He recently wrote commentary for the Leader about the political legacy of former Congressman Carl Mundt. Kevin Wooster is also a longtime South Dakota journalist. For example, he's reported for the Argus Leader, the Rapid City Journal, Kello, and SDPB. He recently wrote about the political legacy of Mount Rushmore National Memorial for South Dakota Searchlight. Wooster joined us from the SDPB Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio. Hunter stopped by the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
And actually, the thought first triggered when I was thinking about presidential debates. Now, Mundt was a champion debater. In fact, he was national president of the National Forensic League for 38 years or something like that, even during his time in Congress, and kind of a renowned public speaker, much more the style of that day than today. But that's what really triggered that. And then I started looking at a few things and discovered that it's the 125th anniversary of his birth early next year. So started recalling it. And he has a big presence in Madison. You know, the Mundt Library is there, the Mundt Archives, the Mundt Foundation was there until it was absorbed into the Dakota State Foundation. So he's kind of considered a native son. If there was a sign on the interstate that would say hometown of Carl Mundt. But I'm not sure many people remember him anymore.
And he served for an astonishingly long time. Tell us a little bit about his longevity in the U.S. Senate.
And not only in the U.S. Senate, but in the House as well.
He served,
A lot of people forget he served 10 years in the House. But He really was remarkably young when he did things. He was right out of college, he went to Bryant, South Dakota, and taught. And after a year, he was named superintendent of the school district. So he's 23 years old or something like that. Then he taught at Dakota State. And then he ran for Congress, served for 36 years. It's, you know, certainly the longest by some distance. Tim Johnson is the second at 28 years. But that's a long time to serve in Congress. And he did it all the way up until a stroke wiped him out and he retired.
So 1936 through 1972, he is in public service on behalf of the people of South Dakota.
And think of what happened during 1936.
You know, a few things.
Yeah. World War II, the civil rights unrest, Vietnam, all sorts of stuff. The Cold War was a big part of what he did and growth. You know, Aeros Data Center is here because of Mundt. The interstate highway, I-29, going up the east side of South Dakota, was intended to go up the west side of Minnesota. And Mundt insisted that it came to South Dakota.
Obviously, also serving that long, there are going to be things that he has to deal with that we look at with a different eye today, including his participation on the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is widely seen as a place where they were trying to root out disloyalty in America. This is a Cold War artifact. But you think that that is not necessarily a stain on his record. How come?
Well, the committee, right, and trying to think of the perspective of the time that it was in. We certainly were fearful of the creeping communism during that time. And then, of course, McCarthyism really took over, where you got this paranoia and really untruths about, you know, lots of U.S. government officials being communists. And I think with today's lens, I think we'd look at the Hollywood thing where you'd have all these accusations of communists and blackballing and so forth. By today's lens, we'd think that's terribly unfair. But I think there was a lot of fear in those days. Mundt's role on that anti-American activities committee, at least through what his biography and people at the Mundt Foundation, which a lot of them worked for Mundt and so therefore are probably biased toward Mundt, really talked about him as a voice of reason within that thing. Let's try to find the truth here. Let's just not run with popular sound bites. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. Again, I've only heard that one side, but that he served with distinction on that committee.
How is he remembered in Madison today, or in South Dakota today?
Interestingly, that his Senate papers congressional papers are all housed at Madison. Okay. And so researchers come there, and it has to do with, certainly around the fall of communism, there was a great interest about Mundt and his time there, but other things as well. So we do get researchers come to Madison, look that up. A lot of it's gone online, so you can do that otherwise. So a few years ago, and I was president of the Mundt Foundation for a while, we promoted a tour, hired a couple of actors who would be Mundt and other people, and did a couple of hundred school districts in the state to try to keep his memory alive. As I recall, that was around his 100th birthday. Now it's be his 125th. So we tried to keep that alive, but there's, other than the Mundt Library, I can't think of anything. Maybe Kevin can think of things that were named for Mundt other than that. I think maybe some, he was big into conservation, so there may be some kind of wildlife refuges or something.
Hmm. Kevin Wooster, thoughts on Carl Mundt and his political legacy in South Dakota? What are some things that you think are worth asking questions about?
Well, I remember in about 1981, I was sitting in the Argus Leader newsroom, and Anson Yeager, who had been the editor and was the editorial page editor then, walked by, and I was writing something, and he said, Anson, is this how you spell Mundt? And I was just double-checking myself, and he stopped, and he said, I never thought I'd hear that question asked in a newsroom. So, and remember, that's 40-some years ago. And so you can imagine how far removed people have gotten from Mundt. I certainly know how to spell McGovern and Knipe.
Dashel.
Or Kniep, as some reporters spelled it back. And you know what really struck me about the kind of the short conversation we had by email about with John, and when we talked about the stroke that the senator had in, what, November of 69 or somewhere in there?
Remarkably, that was right after, may have been the peak of his career, the dedication of the Mundt Library. President Richard Nixon made his first speech outside Washington by coming to Madison and speaking on behalf of his friend Carl Mundt, and then 5 months later has a debilitating stroke that wipes him out.
Yeah, and when we talked, and you brought a point up that I hadn't thought about in years, what would have happened? He was so impaired that he couldn't really function, and his wife was kind of overseeing the office for him, and the staff was doing, working the job. People, including the staff, were just trying to get him to resign eventually and resign his office. And had he, instead of serving it out the rest of that term, who knows who would have been the next U.S. senator in that spot had the Republican Frank Farrar, the governor at the time, been able to fill it.
Well, how did he serve it out if he was incapacitated, John?
Well, not very well.
Not very well.
Yeah, and Kevin and I talked a little bit about that, a kind of a smudge on his record, but really not of his own fault, right? It's not his fault he had a stroke. So
he was incapacitated.
Completely incapacitated. So they were even testing to see if he could say yes, nod yes. He couldn't speak at all, couldn't really move. And so they concluded that he could not even nod yes or no effectively. Mm-hmm. So the idea of resigning that office fell to his wife, Mary. And the staff, led by Bob McCoy, and there are other names that you'd know, Kevin, who were in that office, worked really hard to try to get him to resign that seat with honor. But the Senate had 99 seats for 3 years. So it was an awful situation. The other congressional leaders and so forth were very sympathetic at the beginning, but that wore away. And then it went to frustration and then eventually to anger. So by not resigning, it really was a steep downhill slide for Mundt. And, if you remember at the time, Frank Farrar was the governor, 2-year terms at that time. So he was governor from 69 to 71, January of each year. So if Mundt had the stroke in 69, he could have resigned, and Farrar, a Republican, would have replaced him with another Republican. But he didn't. Dick Knipe came in 2 years later. But eventually he never did resign. Yeah. So
Knipe is a Democrat, for people who don't remember.
Right.
Yeah.
And then so Jim Abaresque, a Democrat, took that Senate seat.
Yeah.
Afterwards. So, it is a rough thing. But really, I think you have to say at least from my view and others, it was Merrymont who caused that stain at the end of his career, and not, you know, Carl didn't cause his own stroke. So it was a sad ending. I remember the funeral in Madison. You know, he's buried in Madison. I think his legacy in Madison is still strong among those. You know, you'd have to be fairly old to have known him at this point. But I think his reputation is good.
John Hunter and Kevin Wooster and I recorded that conversation yesterday. Now, you heard John Hunter mention U.S. Senator Tim Johnson. You may have also heard by now that Senator Johnson died today. His former chief of staff, Dre Samuelson, said in a statement that Johnson died surrounded by his family and also surrounded by love and admiration. Tim Johnson served in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1987 to 1997. Then a South Dakotan sent him to the U.S. Senate. He never lost an election, but after a brain hemorrhage in 2006, followed by an inspiring recovery, he decided not to seek re-election in 2014. I reached Stephanie Herseth Sandlin via phone this morning. She is currently the president of Augustana University in Sioux Falls. She was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2004, where she went on to serve 4 terms. She was the first woman elected to the U.S. House from South Dakota and the youngest woman serving in Congress during that time.
Yes, this is a sad day. You know, so many of us loved Senator Johnson and Tim. Well, I just greatly admired and respected his service to South Dakota and our country, and it was an honor to serve with him and an even greater honor to call him my friend.
Yeah. When he talked about South Dakota, whether it was about South Dakota politics or what the people needed or just about the state, what's one thing that you remember came up again and again? What was one of his themes of this place and these people?
A rich heritage, diverse perspectives, people that stayed grounded, practical, wanted the best out of their government and their representatives. And he represented that, right? He was the consummate statesman and listened well to all of his constituents. He loved South Dakota. We both made our home in the state in Sioux Falls after we left public service. And it was his dedication to everyone he connected with, whether in agriculture for our farmers and ranchers, whether it's deep commitment to our state and country's veterans, the trusting relationships he developed with tribal communities and leaders, business leaders across the state. He was South Dakota. You know, he clearly put state and country first.
Yeah. Were there ways that you learned about him, about leadership, either something he told you or something that you picked up by watching him that you still apply today?
Yes. Tim was a humble servant leader. His humility, from the time I knew him as a young girl, when he and my dad were serving in the legislature together, to interning with him in Washington, D.C. when I was in college, to then running for office alongside him in 2002 and then serving with him. He just remained so grounded in the values of South Dakota, reflected those in the very best way in his service, both in Pierre and in Washington. And he was a role model for me. And I felt I could always talk to him about anything, the things that we were working on together in public policy, or sometimes the things that were really hard on the campaign trail. But we also celebrated great joys together. I remember when his first grandson was born. I remember how great he was to me when I was first serving South Dakota in the, after the special election. He just was, I felt he was always in my corner, and he was someone I could always talk to and trust.
And here is Senator Tim Johnson's longtime chief of staff speaking with SDPB's Lee Strubinger.
It's hard to imagine someone living a life more meaningful and impactful than Tim's. And in the end, impact and meaning are really the best that any of us can hope to achieve. Tim succeeded in reaching the goals of meaning and impact way beyond what I'm sure were his wildest dreams when he was a young man. But that success obviously doesn't make saying goodbye to him any easier, I know. And there's nothing that anyone can say that will help that, much as I wish otherwise. Somewhat ironically, considering the name, in the second book of Timothy, it says, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Those words fit Tim Johnson perfectly. He fought the good fight, he finished the race, and he did keep the faith. Those of us who mourn his loss today also celebrate his life and the lives of all those whom he touched and will continue to touch in the future through his good works.
How did he accomplish that as a politician?
Well, he was smart, obviously. He worked very hard, and he was he was truly one of the most determined people that I've ever known, if not the most determined. It was a combination of those things. He had great work ethic. He was really smart, and he would work like a dog to achieve a goal. When he was in high school, he had the record for the most touchdowns in Vermilion High School for decades. It wasn't because, in my opinion, that he was such a great athlete. He was obviously a good athlete, but I think it was mostly because he was just so determined he refused to get tackled. And I think that showed up in his later life. In fact, I know that it did.
What was it like working with him? And can you remind me a little bit about your time with him in D.C.?
Well, I stayed with him. I was the only chief of staff he had in his entire congressional career, and that was 28 years. So obviously I found it easy to work with him. He was a wonderful human being. He was kind. I mean, he could be demanding as he needed to be, but he treated people with great respect, even if he didn't agree with them.
We'll bring you more on the legacy of U.S. Senator Tim Johnson as people gather to remember. Find the latest online at sdpb.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Amendment F would allow state lawmakers to impose work requirements for Medicaid eligibility for some recipients. Earlier in the hour, we heard from opponents of the amendment. Now we hear from South Dakota Representative Tony Van Huysen. He represents District 13 in Sioux Falls. He was the prime sponsor of the measure in the House.
In the United States, we have Medicare and Medicaid. Those were both set up in the 1960s. Medicare is purely a federal program that provides health care for the elderly. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Medicaid, set up at that same time, is a state-federal partnership to provide health care for people below a certain income level, for the poor. And it's funded at about a 50-50 state-to-federal match, and that's been in place in South Dakota for 50 years. And that traditional Medicaid program covers the elderly in nursing homes, not their health care costs, but nursing home costs, children, pregnant women, and the disabled, all below a certain income threshold. That's been in place in South Dakota for a long time. It's funded by a state-federal partnership. Medicaid expansion came into play as part of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which passed in 2010, I think. And it expands Medicaid eligibility, that's why it's called that, to working age adults who are not disabled, or who are, you would say, able-bodied, working age able-bodied adults. And it does it at a 90-10 match. So the feds will pay 90%, the state pays 10%. This, of course, is done to incentivize states to do it. So it's expanding Medicaid to cover this new population. That was offered starting in 2010 or so. South Dakota was among the states that had not adopted it. So 2 years ago, it was put on the ballot, a constitutional amendment, significantly, not an initiated measure, which would be a statute, but a constitutional amendment requiring that South Dakota expand Medicaid. That passed. I think, and no one's ever really disagreed when I say this, that the state has done a conscientious job of implementing that. Department of Social Services, it's been in place now since July 1st of a year ago. There's, I think, 26,000 people who have enrolled, which is probably about half the number who are eligible, but it goes up every month. The legislature has been funding it. In fact, I have advocated for pre-funding it to make sure that it's built into our budget and we don't take a big hit all at once. That's all in place. What Amendment F brings up is a phrase that was in that amendment passed 2 years ago that says, you can't impose any requirements on the expansion population that are not imposed on the traditional population. That's not word for word, but that's the gist of it.
Impose greater or additional burdens or restrictions on eligibility or enrollment standards.
Exactly. Well, what does that mean? You want to talk about a work requirement to say, you know, you're a working age adult, you should be able to have a job. If you want to get a benefit from the state, you should show that you have a job or you have a reason not to. That's something we do for our other social programs, food stamps, temporary assistance for needy families. The issue here is you would never impose a work requirement on the traditional Medicaid population because, again, remember who they are: children, the elderly, the disabled, pregnant women. It would be nonsensical. It's not nonsensical. I mean, there's some people who think it's a good idea or a bad idea, but it's not nonsensical to say a working age, able-bodied adult should be able to be working to receive this benefit. So the purpose of Amendment F is to say that you can consider a work requirement. It doesn't say there has to be one. It doesn't say there's going to be one. It removes that prohibition to say if in the future the state wants to consider a work requirement for this population, the expansion, working age, able-bodied adult population, that's an option that's on the table.
Okay. So,
sorry, that's a long answer.
But it's an important answer to understand what exactly we're talking about here. So Medicaid expansion, that the up to $41,400 in income for a family of four. So this is who you're thinking about, income level of family of four making up to $41,400, which is not a lot of money for a family of four to be making, especially with the cost of childcare. For people who say to you, the voters were clear that they didn't want this restriction before, and now you're coming at it 2 years later saying, would you let us make this distinction in the future? And that's troublesome to some people. What is your response to that? To the hey, we decided this.
Yeah, the will of the voters is very important to me. I think it's a good thing that this being a constitutional amendment is back on the ballot so the voters get to express their will again. This isn't something the legislature is going over their heads to do. You know, the thing about the ballot measure process is you're given a yes or no question. It's on the ballot. Do you want Medicaid expansion or not? And this language about not allowing extra requirements is part of the deal. You either have to vote yes or no. There's no middle box where you can write in, yes, I want expansion, but I think there should be a work requirement. So I think on this question of the work requirement, the will of the voters is not entirely clear because that question wasn't put squarely before them. If you were somebody who thought we should have Medicaid expansion but with a work requirement, there wasn't really a box for you to check. You were picking an answer, yes or no, that was only part of what you wanted. So I see this as a clarifying question. We're going back to the voters with a more specific, narrow question and saying, okay, you wanted expansion, you've gotten it, we're implementing it, it's working out fine. What about a work requirement? Should this be on the table or not?
Sort of an interesting way to look at the conversation between constituents and the electorate and their representatives.
Yeah, and
that we would do it in this way with the Constitution at the ballot box.
It is, and it's a weakness of the ballot measure process versus the legislative process. If you have a bill in the legislature, you have two committee hearings and two floor sessions and all these opportunities to amend it and have some give and take. So something like this could be hashed out during the legislature. Again, with a ballot measure, it's yes or no. There's really no amendment process once it's on the ballot. So you end up with these kind of refinements that you maybe wouldn't have had on a different issue that had gone through the legislature.
And the critics would say, you failed to act on this,
understood. That's just it's a more general comment that there's no way to propose an amendment to a ballot measure once it's on the ballot.
All right, so why do you think that it should be there? Why do you think, what problem is it going to solve for you to have the option as a policymaker to create a work requirement?
Well, first of all, I think to the extent that we can, we shouldn't be putting policy judgments into the Constitution. It ties the hands of future voters, future legislators, future governors. That's why we have elections. It's why we elect people to make these decisions. But more specific to this point, in South Dakota, our philosophy has always been social programs are a hand up during tough times. They're not a way of life. There are people on Medicaid expansion who see this as a long-term answer for healthcare, that this should be something that people are on for years, and this is how they're getting their healthcare. In fact, they'd probably like to see it expanded further.
Can you quantify that? There are people who think that this should be a permanent solution.
Well, I mean, I've never polled it, but it's certainly the people who've I've discussed this issue with. There are clearly people on the other side of this issue who see more government healthcare for a larger group of people as a goal to strive for. I do not see it that way, and I think Medicaid should be something to help people in tough times, help someone, who's elderly, who's disabled, make sure kids are covered, but then for working-age adults, help them get to something better. Help them get to the point where they're once again able to, support themselves, get their own health care. And if they're able to work and are choosing not to, we should be incentivizing them to work. Now, you haven't asked me about the exceptions. I bet you're going to get to that. But that question always comes up, well, what about the exceptions? I would tell you every other work requirement South Dakota has. If you're a college student, there's an exemption. If you're a parent taking care of little kids, or if you're taking care of a sick relative, or if you have, a cancer patient or some health care reason, or significantly, if you live in the part of the state where you can't find a job, say in a reservation area, all those exemptions are available. So this is not where we have work requirements, they're not administered in a punitive or in an unreasonable way.
So the problems that you're trying to solve is not that you're trying to get more people into the workforce. It's not that you're trying to save money for the state of South Dakota per se because there's a loophole that exists in the current policy that you can quantify financially. Is this more of a philosophical, you don't think policy should belong in the Constitution? I mean, there's a couple different ways where you could say, hey, we want to encourage people to be in the workforce because we need a stronger workforce. We have very low employment. Or you could say, hey, so we want to incentivize that. Or any of these other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I think I'm mainly motivated by the philosophy that our social programs should be short-term, helping people who need the help and not a long-term answer, that we should be helping people move on to something better. I don't think policies like this belong in the Constitution in most cases. But I would say to the other points you raised, I mean, we have very low unemployment in South Dakota. Most people should not struggle to find a job if they want to. It might not be the exact job that they hope to have, but there are jobs for just about anyone who's looking. I have never pitched this as a cost-saving measure. I've been careful not to do that. That's not to say that it couldn't potentially save a little money. I think that's very speculative, and it's really not what's motivating me. What's motivating me is the idea that this should be, that this is the way we should operate a social program, social welfare safety net program.
So I want to think back to the pandemic and some of the things that we learned to create some hypotheticals here. Mm-hmm. One of the things we learned about how many of us took work for granted, and then all of a sudden we had to make adjustments to how we were going to do that work. Many people lost their jobs. Many other people, we talked a lot on this show about the dignity of work in the sense that jobs that some people maybe didn't think mattered as much turned out to be incredibly essential workers. Mm-hmm. And so we were all thinking of what labor meant. And we were thinking about our own illnesses, where there was a time we'd probably just tough it out and come to work with that cough and sniffle. And then it became, we might need to stay away from the office. And those of us who had health insurance and vacation time were able to do that from a point of privilege to not infect other people. So what I'm wondering is the kind of worker that is more likely to be impacted by a chronic illness or by a cancer treatment, for example, might be a laborer, might be a lower income worker, especially at this, the family income rate that encompasses Medicaid expansion. So hypothetically, if somebody who is a lower paid restaurant worker, for example, has a chronic illness, it might be really hard in their vulnerable state to get to work. It might make their life less healthy. When you look at the different hypotheticals for people who might be impacted by the policy. And again, the amendment is not saying there's going to be this policy. It's going to give you the opportunity to debate it and make decisions about it.
Right.
But when we start having that conversation, what comes to mind for you for some of the hypotheticals?
Well, you probably know I was the governor's chief of staff during COVID. So the first thing that came to mind is sometime when you have an hour or two free instead of 15 minutes, I can come back and we can talk about all the things that COVID changed and everything you learned. It brings back a lot of memories. But, you know, again, I think that the key here is to emphasize that when we have a work requirement in our other social programs, food stamps or TANF, that they're administered in a reasonable way. And I think that they have been. And so if you're a person who, you know, in fact, it says right in the measure that you have to be, it doesn't apply to anyone who's medically found to be physically or mentally unable to work. If you're a person who's medically vulnerable for some reason and that limits your ability to find a job, that is exactly the kind of thing you'd have an exemption for. Now, the other thing I would mention is during the COVID pandemic, which, you know, hopefully we don't ever live through anything like that again in our lives, all these rules were waived for at least a year. In fact, they weren't even checking. Generally, if you're on Medicaid, they check periodically to see if your income has changed because you have to stay, you know, if your income gets too high, you're not eligible anymore. They stopped even checking that. So the Medicaid rules just kept going up and up and up and up and up for more than a year. All these work requirements, everything like this would be waived in the case of a pandemic.
As a policymaker, you think a lot, I'm guessing, about the regulatory balance. You know, when have you put too much red tape or too many things that you have to jump through, too many regulations, so that people turn away from things that they're eligible for and that you do want to give them, versus making it so loose and light and easy to get benefits that, you know, there are loopholes and opportunities for people to take advantage.
Yeah.
Do you think that, because this is another one of the criticisms, that adding a work requirement would further keep people from applying for the benefits that they are eligible for?
You'd want to be sensitive to that as you were designing it. I would just say a couple things make me feel confident that we could do it. The first one, as I've mentioned, is we do this in other social programs now. It would be the same department, the Department of Social Services, that already administers the other work requirements that would be administering this one. So to a pretty high extent, you're going to have experience with how to set these up. You're going to have people who've already done it. This isn't going to be reinventing the wheel. The second thing I would say is every Medicaid recipient under old traditional or expansion, there's an income limit, which means you have to show what your income is. Well, if you're already showing what your income is, demonstrating where it comes from does not seem like much of a leap. I mean, for most people, it's going to come from their job, right? And so I don't think the administrative burden of showing that you're working is a lot greater than the administrative burden of showing what your income
is. Maybe looking, showing that you're looking for work might be.
Yes, and of course,
when you're also having chemotherapy or, you know, a chronic illness, so that would be the, you know, showing that you're out looking for a job, I think that would be a more salient argument.
Or if you're medically unable because of an illness.
Yeah, if you have a chronic depression, it might be hard to go job hunting.
Which, again, are exemptions in the current benefits, too.
That was South Dakota Representative Tony Venhuizen arguing for Amendment F. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about philanthropy in Native American communities. Lori Currier, Valeria Big Eagle, Nick Hernandez, and Tashina Banks Rama are in conversation. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.